out there. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the first order of business is to inform you of our first quiz coming up on the principal parts. So if you have Getch's, we probably hadn't brought it along, but I'll tell you what's going to transpire here. If you look at the back of Getch's, if you have it handy, and if someone's got one you can look on, you need to do it that way. What we're going to do is break up this last section of principal parts on pages 330 to 332 into about five sections. We're not going to cover all of these, but most of them. And we're just going to have basically vocab quizzes on these. So it'll just be a little bit more sophisticated vocab quiz in that you need to be informed of all the principal parts here of each verb. But you don't need to decline them any further than this, or, you know, or conjugate them any further than this. In other words, all you'll be responsible for is the form that's given on the chart, which will be your first person singular form, basically. So the first quiz that we'll have, we'll make it, I don't know what day of the week is the best day for quizzes. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, how many of you prefer Tuesdays for a quiz? Okay. Wednesdays, Thursdays, is there anything that Thursdays works the best? Okay. Yeah, it's bad, whatever it is. It doesn't look like it's going to be any huge problem any way you look at it. Maybe we'll just make... Yeah,
Tuesday.
Yeah. How many prefer not Tuesday? Okay. Just one? All right. Well, let's make it Wednesday. We'll make it Wednesday. You prefer not Wednesday?
Yeah.
Okay, several of you do? Okay, well, that's all right. If we've got some strong preferences against it, it doesn't matter. Make a particle difference to me. Is Thursday the best? Okay, that's a good way to end the week. All right? Thursdays, then. We'll make it next Thursday, then. Not this Thursday, but a week from this Thursday. So who's got the date for that? And then I'll tell you exactly what it'll be. Week from this coming... Huh?
Next week after that, Eric.
Yeah, not this coming.
24th?
Okay, Thursday, 24th. Okay, now, this first quiz is going to cover the principal parts on page 330, and it'll cover all of them, let's see, down to didasco, from ago to didasco, with a few exceptions, and I'll tell you which ones you don't need to worry about. But all those from starting with ago, the first one, down to didasco, including didasco, will not include didomi. So the dividing line is between didasco and didomi there. And it will not include ireo, the second one. You can eliminate that. Anoigo, the one, two, three, four, five, the sixth one down. Anoigo, you can eliminate that. And the second to the third to the last and the second to the last, deknumi and deomai, you can omit those two. I'm just trying to hit the ones that are the most common. So it's all of those except for the four that I listed. Ireo is not on it, anoigo is not on it, deknumi is not on it, and deomai is not on it, but all the others. So you'll be responsible for ago, iro, akuo, amartano, bino, balo, ginomai, ginosko, grafo, and didasko. Now, as far as the quiz is concerned, what I'll be doing is, I'll say, what you'll need to know is, you'll need to know the meaning of the verb that's given here. Don't need to do any word study, but you should need to know that ago is to lead. You'll need to know all of these principal parts. And the way we'll handle that is, I'll either give me the perfect active of ago, for example, or the perfect middle and passive of ago, or whatever. And you'll just give the form that's printed there. You don't need to worry about any further conjugations. And or I may give you the form, and you have to identify what it is. In other words, I may put ermai down, and you'll have to tell me it's perfect middle and passive from iro. So the quiz will go both directions. And you need to know the meanings of them and so forth, too. I may just say, give me the perfect active of the verb to raise or take up, you know, and then you'd need erka. So that's the kind of thing we're looking at. It won't be a long quiz. It won't take that long. It's one of those that's either you know it or you don't, basically. Now also notice that some of them have blanks. You need to know where the blanks are too. In other words, you need to know where there is no form, although I probably am not going to be so tricky as to try to require that you leave a blank on your paper or something. But do pay attention to that, though. There's certain forms, like Didasco, for example, has no perfect forms. Okay, yes, Mark?
How about those with more than one form?
Oh, if they've got more than one form, all you'll need on the quiz is one of those to satisfy it. Now, although, if I go the other direction and give you one of them, I guess you do need to be familiar with the various forms that exist. But if I ask you for the form, you can just probably put down the first one. If on the other hand, I give you one of them, I may choose any of those just so that you're familiar with the variations. For Anoigo, for example, your aristactive, you've got three possible forms. They're similar, but and then the aorist passive is the same thing. Perfect middle passive is the same thing. Yes, go ahead.
What would you say would be the definition of a final? They don't really give one.
They don't really give it. That's a good point. If I ask you for meaning, I'll probably give it as anabino, probably. But bino means basically to go, and then anabinos go up, katabino to go down, and so forth. So I think when I ask you for an actual form, let's see. You know, this would only be a problem if I ask you for meaning on those, and I don't think that's going to really come up. Let's put it this way. If I ask you for meaning of it, and you don't have anything but a combination form, just give the one example combination form they give, and just say, in other words, if I ask you what does bino mean, so forth, and just put down anabino means to go up or ascend, you know. That's about all you need to do. I don't think that's going to be a problem. But several of these, they do give you the ones that occur frequently in combination. They may just give you the root form. So that way it covers all of those other possibilities. In other words, if you know what bino does, then you've got anabino, katabino, and all the rest. Okay, any other questions? So Thursday then, the 24th, we'll have our first quiz on this. There'll be five total to cover these principal parts. And the only reason we're taking some time with this is just because these verbs are the ones that are most common. That's what they're selected for here. And we want to get you familiar with the basic. Now, once you know these principal parts, then in theory, you can construct the entire paradigm for the verb.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So, just rejoice that we're not asking you for every conceivable conjugation of it. Yes, right. Okay, so that's that. Today I want to continue in Dane and Manthi here on these case functions. So if you have Dane and Manthi with you, you can grab one off the shelf there. We'll resume that. Anybody? John's okay. Okay, page 81 is where we left off. We just began the discussion of the ablative. We were talking about the genitive and all of the different subcategories thereof. And now we're looking at the ablative, which this book treats as a separate case. Some books treat it not as a separate case, but a special category of the genitive, since its form is the same. So section 91, this case has seldom occurred in Indo-European languages with a distinctive ending of its own, but it does have quite a distinct function. The name suggests the basal significance of the case, ablativus, that which is born away or separated. Its basal significance is point of departure, the idea of departure, separation, that type of thing. This idea may be elemental in various conceptions. It is involved not only in the literal removal of one object from the vicinity of another, but in any idea which implies departure from antecedent relations, such as derivation, cause, origin, and the like. It contemplates an alteration in state from the viewpoint of the original situation, as when we say, ho soteria tes amartias, we are considering salvation from the standpoint of man's original condition of bondage in sin. So salvation from sins is the idea of a separation from sins and deliverance from that and a removal from the original condition. The use of the ablative comprehends an original situation from which the idea expressed is in some way removed. Hence, in the simplest terms, we may say that its root idea is separation. So separation is the idea that they're looking at here, and any kind of separation, either a physical separation of an object from the vicinity of another object, or more of a conceptual separation, which may involve time or space or just concept separation. So here we'll break this down into subcategories. Number one, the ablative of separation, which is going to, of course, be the most obvious and straightforward of these. This use is where the ablative presents its simple basal significance unaffected by any associated idea. Okay. Apolotriomenoi tes politeas to Israel, having been alienated from the commonwealth of Israel. Okay, the ablative idea here is this tes politeas to Israel, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel. And they're translating it from, even though there's no preposition here, because of the ablative idea, the idea of separation. The idea of alienation, you see, is indicating an alienation from something else. And it's not really being derived from that other thing. It's not being defined so much by that other thing like the normal genitive is used. But you could call this a subcategory of genitive in terms of a kind of definition, namely a separation idea. But he's analyzing this as what's called ablative or separation, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel, separated from, the idea of separation. You might have even expected to see an apo there, and of course the preposition apo would certainly give a clear picture of the idea of separation. Yes?
Isn't that part of his verb?
Yes, it is. It's contained in the verb there because you do have an op there. And you'll often see that if the preposition apo isn't seen out, externally, you'll often see it. You'll see a lot of verbs with this idea of apo and separation seen in the verb form. So that's a good observation. And in effect, this is almost taking a genitive object type of, use, an alienated from. Would almost have to. You could almost take the from as a part of the verb, as far as your translation is concerned. Okay, there's a few other examples here that you can, if you want, take time to look up and check those out as well. Then we've got ablative of source. The idea of separation may be accompanied by the implication that the original situation contributed in some way to the present character or state. That which is named in the noun modified by the ablative owes its existence in some way to that which is denoted in the ablative. So we have diates parakleseos ton graphon through the consolation from the scriptures. This one, I think, is quite debatable. You could just as easily, in my opinion, analyze this as just a genitive, and a genitive indicating source or kind. The idea of separation gets a bit fuzzy here. And consolation from the scriptures, in a sense you may see a separation, that your present consolation is coming from that source, but I don't know that we can really say that a person is really that separated from the scriptures. That one to me is quite debatable. And of course you'll see it analyzed differently in different books as well. So the ones that argue that there's no difference between the ablative could use examples like this and say, see, there's no difference at all. I mean, this is just a genitive. Consolation from the scriptures. A scripture kind of consolation. That's where it's coming from. So I suppose the idea is that in English we're translating this from, and therefore from seems to indicate, that this has been derived from this, so there's some kind of a separation involved, but I'm not sure that... Well, yes, I think what they're thinking of is that the events that transpired in the scriptures happened long ago, and we're reading about those, and we're gaining some benefit from them now, but, events happened a long time, so there was a separation in time or in concept. There's a book and here's a person, Yeah. So I'll leave that to your own judgment, what you want to do. Because really, obviously, it's not going to make any significant difference in our exegesis whether we go 8-case system or 5-case system, as long as we understand the function and the meaning of the thing, of the passage in question. But like I said, I noted this one is debatable. Any other questions or comments, observations on that? Okay. The ablative of means, Third category. The ablative is not the regular case used in expressing means, but may be used when the expression of means is accompanied by an implication of origin or source. Well, for the same reason that the above one is indebatable, then I think this one is one of the fuzzy ones. You can see by the example here, too. He's got hikanos de klaphmos agenetopanton. There was great lamentation by all. Now, this phrase by all, panton, here is what he's signifying as an example of ablative of means. And he gives a note here. It may be readily seen in the example given that the sense would still be preserved if panton were rendered from all. The means or agency is the same, is at the same time the source. By far the greatest number of the occurrences of this construction in the New Testament are with the preposition hupo. Remember, hupo with the genitive was your normal mode of expressing direct agency. The so-called genitive of material measurement belongs in this class. Okay, the genitive of material or measurement belongs in this class. Okay, what he's getting at here is that, and I think he's almost admitting that this is kind of a fuzzy area. There was great lamentation by all. The idea there is that the lamentation is coming from all the people. That's the source of the lamentation. And this is that idea of direct agency. In other words, it's the mode that's commonly used, hupo with a genitive idea, indicating the direct agent, direct source. And because he's connecting this concept with source, he's connecting it with the previous use of an ablative of source, which, as I said, seems to me to be a bit debatable. Okay, and this genitive material, I think what he's getting at there is, you know, to talk about something of something, you know, a temple of stone or something like that. And there again, the source of the temple's construction was stone, that type of thing. But again, to me, it's just a clear example of a genitive showing the kind of material it's made of. So that's probably the way I would analyze it. Mark?
Are you saying that this scripture or the entire idea of the ablative of means?
Oh, I think the whole idea is debatable. And I don't want to be dogmatic. I mean, I really don't care that much whether you analyze this as ablative or genitive. But just saying that the idea of separation to me doesn't seem to be so strong here, no matter whether it's this scripture or any one in which you're calling it an ablative of means, you know, because it would be indicating direct agency. That's basically what he's saying, a direct agent. And a direct agent for an action and so forth, the prepositional phrase is specifying the one who's performing the action and therefore, in a sense, defining the action. And to me, I don't see so much a gross separation idea between the action and the source of the action. Sometimes it's just intimately connected, but it's just defining that action and showing where it's come from. But the fact, I think, since we in English commonly use the preposition from, you know, the great lamentation from all and so forth, that's probably why he's saying, here we got the idea of separation. I'm not so sure that it's quite that clear. It depends on how you want to analyze it and where you want to draw the lines. Yes?
After looking at the genitive and all the different ways the genitive is used,
yes,
for instance, action, object,
mm-hmm.
Why can't you just... I mean, I don't, yeah, like you said, you have to have a source of meaning.
Right.
Supposed to play in genitive.
Yeah.
And why can't you just say a genitive of source and a genitive of means that way and just call those genitive?
Sure. Some books do.
Genitive of ablative.
Yeah.
Or genitive of
some generative. Of them call it an ablative genitive. In other words, they will. You don't.
I don't get the distinction.
Okay. In his mind, it's simply that Dane and Manti have chosen to go on an 8-case system. And because of parallels to other languages and so forth, they decided to go this route. But you may look up another book, and they will do exactly what you said. They will categorize a genitive of means, a genitive of source, and an ablative genitive to cover that first one there. Just a genitive of separation. You know, and they're not disagreeing on the idea of separation in that one, that first example. They're just differing on what they're going to call it. So some are going by the, you know, case form. It's the same case form. And so they just call it a genitive and call it an ablative genitive. And really, I'm not too worried about that. I was inclined to do anything on these, and especially when we get to the dative, too. That's where it's the genitive versus ablative and dative versus instrumental locative where this big issue resolves. That I suppose I'd be more inclined to go by the forms and then just look at these as various categories of the forms. But I certainly wouldn't disfellowship anybody because they went to the 8-case system. But I think, you know, that's the thing I want you to see is that don't... don't feel like you've got to go one way or the other. In other words, if you understand what's happening, understand that we're just trying to categorize various forms that we find. We look at the Greek language and we find four basic case forms. And the ones who are more inclined to compare it to other languages and so forth, they're looking for eight. The other ones are just inclined to look for the forms that you see. And I suppose I'd rather be looking at the forms that you see and drawing conclusions on that than the other, but all I'm interested really in is categorizing these so we can be a little bit more observant about how we're looking for things. Tony?
It seems to me that the biggest way that they divide these things up is more by a contextual feel for what they think the verse means.
Yeah. And how are you translating in English? Sure.
So
sure.
If you need that kind of reasoning, it's very subjective.
It is very subjective. There is no question about the subjectivity involved.
You can analyze the context slightly different way.
Sure.
You can put a different label on it and be fine.
Sure.
Labels are unimportant, though.
Yeah. It's the function that we're looking for. It's the function we're looking for. And that's why there's going to be overlaps, and sometimes you can get confusion. Well, is this an objective or is this a subjective? Well, two guys might analyze completely differently. And so that's the thing you have to keep in mind. In fact, these categorizations may be useful as a means just to, and that's why I'm not even going to ask you to memorize all of these, because, who cares really as far as, another guy might come up with something different. But as far as observation of the kinds of uses that can occur, whether you group them together in this group or that group is not the important thing so much as really seeing the various ways in which Greek is going to use these things. But the big problem, I think, is that's occurred far too often is a kind of a bondage to English, almost, of looking at how the English is translating it. And I think they see this word from, in English, and so they're saying, from. That's got the idea of separation, and therefore they read that back into the Greek. And that may not be the point that they're even thinking. The Greek may not be thinking about separation at all when he's not thinking of from. He's just got a genitive form. So that's something to keep in mind. Is there another question on this? This last one I think is kind of interesting too, especially for the Hebrew students.
Just to refresh my memory, I can't remember now. Are there Greek grammar books of the age, in other words, like written at the time of Josephus or something that gave their own distinction?
Oh, I'm not familiar with anything that's complete. Yeah, it's bits and pieces that we're getting. I think they probably have tablets and so forth or papyri that'll show conjugations and things like that. I wouldn't be a bit surprised. But as far as the Greeks are concerned themselves, they may not be. That's something that would be interesting to ask them when he gets here too, just to see in their own grammar books. In fact, I've got one book that he gave me. I think I may take a look. Yeah. If they, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they break this down somewhat, just to see, just to show the range of things. But I doubt very much that they would be breaking it up this way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that would really be interesting. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think you've made a good point. That's the way we often think, is that these poor Greeks are trying to say, if they only had English, then they could say it right, And they're just trying to approximate our beautiful language that has no flaws. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think you've got the point here, at least. That's what I really want to do, is I'm not trying to sow seeds of doubt in your mind, so that you're skeptical of all the scholars, but there's a certain healthy kind of skepticism that you need to have. So you're not just, throwing it out completely, but you begin to see some of how the biases and things work in and take that into account. We're dealing with real human beings that have got, and there's a certain degree of revelation that these people have, too, and most of them not being spirit-filled, not really moving in the spirit and so forth. They're not going to be able to see some things that by the grace of God the Lord has enabled us to see. Well, the last category here, ablative of comparison, this is a very interesting one. It is immediately evident that what has usually been defined as a genitive of comparison is really an ablative. Well, that's debatable. Okay. Immediately apparent, I don't know from what criteria, but comparison obviously implies separation in degree. Thus, meson tou deinos means advanced in position beyond, consequently away from someone. The thought of separation is obvious. The ablative of comparison may be used with a superlative degree. Well, I believe he does have a point here as far as this idea of separation is concerned, but it's not so much an emphasis on the fact that it's separated. It's emphasis upon the comparative nature of things. And you'll see that we've already looked at comparatives, and we've seen that one of the most common ways of showing comparison in Greek is to use the genitive. And now he's calling that an ablative and defining that because of the idea of a separation in degree. Now, here's an example. Uk est endulos meson tu kuriu autu. A servant is not greater than his lord. Literally, a servant is not greater of his lord. And that is a little bit strange to us, but if those of you that are Hebrew students can recall the manner of expression of comparison in Hebrew, they use the preposition min, from, and they say one thing is good from this, you know, and that idea there is pictured as you're looking maybe at a line of this concept, and we're saying that this thing is better than this, meaning on the scale of goodness, this one is further down the scale than this one, and they're separated in that sense of degree of goodness. So there is an idea of separation here, but this can also be just looked at as a genitive, you know, in this category, a genitive comparison, another person might analyze it. But I think you've got a better case for the idea of separation from a conceptual standpoint, but not from a physical, you know, this is not a physical thing, it's a conceptual thing. But that is the picture. And then, of course, my mind wonders whether this is just a Hebraism, you know, the same thought coming in from Hebrew. One would have to check and see if the same kind of thing was used in the papyri and so forth, and it very well may be. It may be just that the idea is common to both languages. That's a possibility. This would be a good one for Jim on his paper to take a look at. Okay. So, like I said, those could all be analyzed as genitives if a person is so inclined, and many are. So this is not a matter where you're bucking all the scholars if you do this. Some of the scholars do the exact same thing. They say, well, there's no difference here. They're just all genitives. But if they do that, they'll usually break it down and add these other categories in the genitive column. And so you'll still see some of these various separations of the ideas, at least to look at them and help recognize. Okay, that brings us to the dative. And section 92, the dative, locative, and instrumental cases are all represented by the same inflectional form, but the distinction in function is very clear, much more so than the distinction between the ablative and genitive, which may, and this I also, how do you say it? I think that he's got some basic distinctions between maybe instrumental use and dative, to me, it's not so much a clear-cut case that this is an obviously a different function. It may be that some are subsets, subcategories of a general broad distinction, and it might be worthy of thinking in that line, especially when we get into the distinction between instrumental and locative. And he'll even make some interesting comments along those lines that I'll draw your attention to as we go on. Recent grammarians nearly all recognize this distinction. Even those of the previous century have discerned it. Blass observes that a distinction must be made between the pure dative, which expresses the person more remotely concerned, the instrumental dative, and dative of accompaniment, and thirdly, the locative, the local dative. Even Gesner Harrison, as far back as 1858, observed the distinction of the instrumental and locative from the dative, though he erroneously confounded these cases with the ablative, influenced, of course, by Latin. So, if case is determined by function, then there can be no question that the third inflectional form of the Greek noun includes three cases, the dative, locative, and instrumental. So, yeah, this is a pretty common observation, the dative, locative, and instrumental of the three basic categories, and most are in agreement as far as how they're breaking it down in general, although there's difference of opinion as to whether you want to call them separate cases or not. So same problem exists here, but it is worthy of consideration here to look into the various functions that we see expressed by the dative. We've already been familiar with this to some extent just from our reading and from our looking at prepositions and so forth. So section 93, the observation of Blass quoted above, that the dative expresses the person more remotely concerned. Without doubt, in line with the root meaning of the case, the dative deals very largely with the personal idea. It is sometimes used of things, but of things personified, having a distinctive personal touch. It is primarily a case of personal relations, and it is with this view that we must interpret it when applied to things. In other words, the dative does refer to things, but it usually refers to things in such a way that there's a personification involved. In other words, you're trying to show something for the interest of that thing. And usually, of course, anytime interest is involved, it's you usually conceive of the thing as in a personal way. We adopt Robertson's view that of the root idea as personal interest. The idea of interest as applied to things becomes reference. So he's defining it as personal interest, and then if it's involving things rather than people, it would be called reference. There's some sort of a reference in the specific nature of the references is colored by the context and other things. So I don't think there's anything real problematical about that analysis. As you'll see, the uses, primary use, of course, indirect object, is very much in line with that idea of interest, personal interest. Okay, so the subcategories, number one, the dative. Now, just dealing with what he calls the dative case, not dealing with the instrumental or the locative now. The dative of indirect object. This use lies nearest to the simple root idea. It indicates the one for whom or in whose interest an act is performed. Thus, it carries the basal significance of the dative. Of course, if you're defining dative as personal reference, personal interest, then, of course, this fits. Panta apodoso soi, I will give you all things. Okay, I will give all things to you, in other words. And so the subject is I, the verb is give, the direct object is panta, all things. That's the thing that's receiving the action of being given. And then soi, to you, is a reference of personal interest. It's, as he indicates, expresses the person more remotely concerned. In other words, it's the one to whom or for whom the action is performed rather than the one who's actually receiving the action. So this is being analyzed as an indirect object. And so your basic use of indirect object in our concept in English is falling into this category. Secondly, the dative of advantage or disadvantage. This isn't hugely different than the idea of indirect object, as you'll see, but growing out of the use of the dative is of indirect object, we have the dative used in a more specific expression of personal interest. If I say, edoken to biblion moi, it is clear that the giving of the book was in my interest. And the sense is not materially changed if it be said that to biblion moi egoraste, the book was bought for me, only making the idea of personal interest more emphatic. The negative aspect of the same idea is the dative of disadvantage. So what he's saying is, we can say, he gave the book to me, and that would be analyzed as a direct object. He, subject, gave, verb, the book, direct object, to me, would be the indirect object. And this next example, to biblion moi egoraste, that would be, he bought the book for me. We wouldn't translate that, he bought the book to me. But he bought the book for me, or the book was bought for me, and this is a passive verb form, the book was bought for me. And even though the form is the same, it's just a dative form here, we're translating it for. And the idea, of course, is just a little bit more emphatic on the interest element. And it's not just he gave it to me, but he bought it for me, and it's really emphasizing the fact that that this is a in the very definite interest of the person, advantage or disadvantage. Can be a negative sense, could be disadvantage also. Now, this could, another person might just analyze this as a subcategory or more specific use of the indirect object idea. Like we've said, in Greek, there's no difference in the construction. It's only context and usually the nature of the verb, the meaning of the verb that will determine the difference there.
Because I think in English we just analyze it as indirect object.
We might very well do that, sure. Yeah. Because in English, either two or four can be analyzed as an indirect object. And there wouldn't be any problem. All right. Another example. Ekrina emauto tuto. I determined this for myself. This one is again indicating an advantage for my own benefit, so that I determined this for myself, and for my own benefit, in other words, for my own advantage, and so forth. I mean, the idea that he's claiming is seen here. I'm not sure how else you might analyze this, but because the English is translating it for, then he's got this idea for the advantage of myself. Okay, dative of possession. This is an idiom for which we have no exact equivalent in English. It is personal interest particularized to the point of ownership. There is in it manifest kinship with the dative of indirect object. Thus, edokin to biblion moi is obviously closely related in sense to biblion esti moi. How would you translate to biblion esti moi? That last phrase. Yes, Eric?
The book is mine.
Yes, the book is mine, or literally, you know, real stilted way, how would you say that?
The book is to me.
Yes, the book is to me. Well, there's the Hebrew students are going to recognize that, because that's exactly the way you say possession in Hebrew, is using the preposition to, lamath, and something such is to me. So that may be also a Hebraism here. It very well may be, since he's suggesting that this isn't real common. Normally, possession is going to be indicated just by a genitive. So here's an example from the scriptures. Kai uk ein autois technon, and they had no child, literally, and there was not to them a child. There was not to them a child. And, of course, that's precisely the way Hebrew expresses this. I mean, it's just a direct literal translation of the Hebrew.
Bishop, I've only had English behind me.
Mm-hmm.
What they're saying, I'd have to do this because this makes sense. But
mm-hmm.
Having learned Hebrew along with it, this idiom, the little way it's coming out in Greek, makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, right. If you're used to it in Hebrew, then this just makes all the sense in the world. If you're not used to it, you know, the students that haven't had the Hebrew and so forth, this may be, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of what they're saying here, as it were. But to me, I don't see this as any, you know, you can call it a dative of possession, or you could just call it just plain a dative that's being used in a context where possession is shown as a result of a translation of a Hebrew idiom. So... But I suppose, you know, for practical purposes, and that's usually what these things are done for, you know, for actual practice of working with the language, you know, you need to be aware that you may see a dative in this instance where possession is being shown. But again, it's that idea of interest. It's the idea, it's a, this book, or they had no child. In other words, there was no child with reference to them. And when dealing with them and discussing them, there's no child involved. That's the idea. And... It's similar to that genitive idea, I suppose, but the emphasis is a bit different. The emphasis is more upon the persons involved here rather than on the child in this case. There was not to them a child, you know. They didn't have a child. It seems to almost kind of put an underline under the word they in the way that this is coming forth. And it's got a more graphic, you know, you could just as easily say that they were childless or something like that. You use an adjective or something, but it doesn't have the same force as this. It's got more force, more emphasis, and so I think that can be done sometimes too. Again, this is one would have to check and see if classical Greek ever used this kind of a mode of expression. They may not have. It may have only been something that the Hebrew influence generated. Again, I can't say that for sure, but I suspect that may be the case. It's certainly exactly what Hebrew does. Okay, then fourth category, the dative of reference. The force of interest in the dative may be diminished to the idea of mere reference. Thus, in edoken to biblion moi oikodome, for edification, the idea of interest is quite emphatic, but not in moi, but is remote in oikodome. So he gave the book to me for edification. The to me is an indirect object, that's the way we would analyze it. And then for edification, that's being seen as a little bit more oblique, as a little bit more distant than the idea of to me. And, of course, oikodome, edification, isn't a personal idea anyway. And so that's why he's saying it's in the category of reference. So the idea of interest is quite emphatic in moi, but is remote in oikodome, though still present. For the word might with good sense be rendered in the interest of edification. He gave the book to me in the interest of edification. And there, of course, you'd be personifying the concept, which, however, is a personification of oikodome. In other words, personification means treating something as if it were a person, as if edification could have an interest. You see, as picturing it as if it were a person, in a certain sense, anyway. This use of the dative occurs mostly with things, though it may also be used with persons. So it can sometimes occur with persons, but the main category is going to be with things now, where you're dealing with a dative of reference. Yes, Tony?
Things like this almost have the idea of a goal or a
for final end on your, you're thinking of a line with a dot at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Stop point, you know,
yeah. Purpose
to edify,
yeah.
The end result of, or the goal of, or, you know, in other words, you're the recipient, final, it's indirect,
yeah.
I'm saying it's almost like stop here.
Yeah.
You know, if you could just string as many of those together, you would need to get your point across.
You will often see preposition pros with the accusative used in cases like this, toward edification, that type of thing, where it's a definite purpose. But I think don't lock this into the idea of purpose, however, because this is a bit indefinite. It's basically the idea of reference, because there'll be other examples. I think there's one that we died with reference to sin. See, apethanomen teha martia. We're not really seeing sin as our goal here, although you might say death to sin is our goal, if you wanted to kind of reword the concept there. Yeah, but the point is, we died with reference to sin. In other words, in fact, you might even analyze this as a locative conceptual thing. We died in the realm of sin. In other words, within that realm, we're dead. That could be done as well. But the idea of reference here is just, you want to try to leave this concept a bit general. And then, of course, the sense in which there's a reference may be gained from the meaning of the words, the context, and other things. The reference may be, like you said in the first example, for edification would be indicating kind of the goal or the destination that you're looking at. This other one, died with reference to sin, may be indicating the realm within which death has meaning. In other words, it's a qualified death. It's not just death, but it's death with reference to sin in that category, you see.
Which
actually,
if we took it, I guess translated literally to the sin,
mm-hmm.
died to the sin.
Yeah, and we can do that, and still, you know, we died to sin or died to sin. Yeah, yeah. And see, in English, when we say we died to the sin, we're saying we died with reference to the sin. I mean, that's the concept that's come across in our mind. In other words, in with reference to sin, or you know, in the category of sin, that's the category that we're dying, and we're picking up things just from the, again, it's from context, because we could use the preposition to in another instance to come out with a direct object, and or we can come out with the idea of toward or motion or lots of things. Our word to is just used so broadly, so we have to be careful that we're trying to understand the picture. This is, again, the bottom line that I want you to see in all of this, when we deal with the article and prepositions and all the rest, is strive for an accurate understanding of the Greek picture. Try to get your mind oriented toward a pictorial analysis of this in concept realm. And then you're going to be a lot more accurate as far as your translation. When you understand the picture, then your translation in English may vary from time to time, but you're trying to translate in English the picture that you're seeing in Greek. That's always a safe way to go. I just groan inside, you know, at this analysis of just trying to find an English word and stuff, you know, and pick out, go through the concordance and pick out, you know, it means in and by and at and so forth. Pick out the one that you want. That's never what the lexicon's intended to do, of course, but that's what many people who have enough knowledge to be dangerous, as we've said, that's the way that it's analyzed. I've run into that so many times. In debating especially, I suppose, more commonly than ever, with Logos in John 1, in the way that people look that up and try to find, you know, confirm the Trinitarian idea.
Right.
Yes.
In this case, that scripture here, Tom Idea has an article, so would that be saying a definite sin in mind?
Well, it could. It could be either a definite sin. This is kind of, it's a good question, because it'll kind of whet your appetite for what we'll deal with the article a bit later on. It can refer to a definite sin. Suppose a particular sin was being discussed in context. Suppose it was fornication or something, and he'd been talking about fornication, the sin of fornication. And then when he says we are dead with reference to the sin, it would probably be referring in that context to the sin of fornication. On the other hand, if nothing clearly was specified as a particular sin, what he may be doing, and what I think is probably happening in this context, is it's the concept of sin itself, the entire concept of sin. We die with reference to the sin. In other words, the whole idea of sin. Rather, you know, not just a kind of a casual general reference to dying to sin, but to the whole realm of sin. Just like you'll find the article with the word faith very often in the same sense, only in a positive sense. The faith is referring just not to the concept of believing, but the whole faith, the whole sum total of all that comprises faith and the doctrine, the teaching, the apostles, and so forth. So the sin, I think, would just be, you know, anything and everything in that category of sin. It's seeming to be a very powerful statement here. We die with reference to the sin. But admittedly, if the context was otherwise, then you'd probably be analyzing that as some specific sin rather than just the whole general concept of sin. But here it's not even the whole general concept of sin. It's very, very definitely specifying that whole thing. It's almost personification. It's almost that sin is being pictured here. And, of course, in Romans 7, he goes on to talk about it very much that way, the sin that dwelleth in me and the, you know, so forth. And he talks about it in very, very personal terms. Okay. Glenn.
Well, it's all reference to what you said. It's like you're seeing a picture here of how the article is used in Greek, though. It's like you're comparing what you're talking about, say, Theos in John 1:1,
right,
particular versus the anarchist. This is not talking about the aspects of sin, but in sin in particular.
Yes. Right, it's not just talking about qualities or characteristics. It's almost speaking of the very identity of sin itself. It's going deeper. And sometimes it's hard to translate, you know, this in English to make it really come out the same way. That's, again, one of the reasons why we're taking Greek, is to be able to pick up on these nuances, these different shades and so forth. And that's why I do want to definitely take some time to spend with the article, because we're going to look specifically at these kinds of uses. And, of course, we'll have some breakdowns and categorizations as well. But those aren't going to be necessarily inspired, but they'll be, again, a learning tool. Okay, Tony?
Just for your sake, the context of how shall we that are dead to sin live any longer therein? Kind of, you know, you're out of that realm.
Right.
Sure.
And how should we live therein, in the sin, you know, in that realm? It's almost, you know, it's drawing some boundaries around it, you see. It's not just a big cloud of nothingness out there. It's a very specified concept. You put the article on something. The article almost always is drawing a boundary around something somehow. Of course, that's the nature of it, is to make it definite. But sometimes we have to discover the realm within which it's definite. It may be definite because it's a proper name or it's a person. It may be definite because it's a particular thing that's been mentioned in the context. It may be definite because it's a pronoun and it's replacing something in the concept that you already have a defined limit around. It's very interesting, and I guess we'll save most of that discussion for later. Okay, that brings us to the locker. Was there another question, Mark?
Well, I was going to say, what seems, what seems to be a weakness of Dina and Manti, and I think also Geshe's, would seem to be they discuss something in abstract, and then they toss a scripture or an example at the end of it, but they really don't develop it or link the two in any way, and it would seem that seems to be a...
You got a good point. If there was a bit of an explanation as to how this example fits it, you know, just to say a few words, well, in this, that would help a bit. That is a good point. And sometimes what I have found is the examples are pretty poor. And some of the ones that you look up these references, they're better than the ones that he gave. So you have to do a little bit of footwork and so forth. I guess what we're really saying is we can use these books as guidelines. And use them as we can use them, but don't take it as something that's been inspired of God or something that cannot be altered and so forth. Because you'll find that. Now, one thing I will say too, if you have the opportunity, either to purchase one or I don't know what they cost now. If this costs this much, I don't know what. But Robertson's great big, thick grammar has. Usually he gets into lots of refinement and detail and things, and he'll give you lots of examples and lots of scriptures and so forth. So if you want to search some of these things out, that's a good source. Not that he's necessarily any more authoritative than some of the others, but it's just that he'll often give you lots more examples to work with. And if you're trying to do an analysis and make a judgment on your own of something, it's good to consult him as a data source. There's just lots more data available. So I've had occasion to do that. And you know, he'll list sometimes, if it's a small point, he'll list all the examples that have that feature or something, and that's really handy because then you can look them up yourself and then draw your own conclusion. Yeah.
He likes the HJ system though, so he's really dogmatic about it.
They're more dogmatic. I don't know. Most of the things I've looked at Robertson in are more detailed, specific examples. You know, so you're not getting his. Yeah, he's probably. If you look at his short grammar, I'll have to review his again and see. Has anybody looked at it recently to see how strong he comes out? Have you looked at Eric? Have you happened to pick up a notice? He mentions him. What do you got there, Mark?
Well, at the bottom of the page, it says that Robertson observes the distinction for the city of Black and Minnesota. So this is much more pronounced than that
between. Yeah, okay. So, he's apparently following this system, but you don't know from this statement whether he's really calling it a separate case or just saying that there is a distinction. And I'm sure Dana and Matthew are saying, this is proof that it's a separate case. So, do you have something there?
Yeah, I was on that basis, example,
uh-huh. Yeah, go ahead. We've got just a couple minutes left. That'd be just enough time. That we don't. This is a natural stopping place here.
Sometimes it's not easy to decide whether the case is documented, mental, or dangerous. Then you have some example. And then in some cases remain at the genitive level, too, but cannot be final as the devil. The matter must seem to remain in abeyance.
Mm-hmm. Just means we're going to put it on the shelf and not worry about it.
Then it says later on here, it may serve as a good exercise to discriminate. In this passage, it was one passage referred to. Each of the cases may explain the distinctive meaning and the result in this special context. The cases have kept us for a good while, but the subject is second to none in importance in Greek syntax. And then say something about your cases. Nowhere has comparative philology shed more light than in the explanation according to historical science of the growth and meaning of the Greek cases.
Okay. So it sounds like he is holding the same basic position as Dana Manti, although he may not be quite as dogmatic about it. It's hard to say. Well, that may be. It's
Robertson, I noticed, has the references.
Yeah.
His long and his short for all these things.
Yeah. So he's using him as a reference. So that's probably where he's getting his ideas, or he's looking for a great authority to establish those. Notice his statement about comparative philology and so forth as being the source from which they're getting this distinction. It's not something that you're seeing obviously from Greek forms. I guess in my opinion, his statement about there's certain examples you can't decide this or that, and you have to just put them on the shelf. There's a certain weakness with that kind of thing in that you get the feeling then that. Something's wrong with the language, the language isn't that precise. And see, that's the cart before the horse. There's nothing wrong with the language. They got along just perfectly fine. It's the grammarians that are having trouble how to pigeonhole these different things. And so I guess the thing that I'm really saying as a bottom line is don't necessarily insist on pigeonholing things so precisely. Just recognize that we're trying to deal with an English language pattern, and we're looking at Greek, and we're coming up with these different categories and so forth for usefulness in our making judgments, and I think there's a place for them, but we don't want to get so dogmatic that something's got to be, it's got to be either instrumental or locative, brother. And I say, it may be both. It may be both those ideas. What it probably really is, it's really a dative form in Greek, and we're worried because we're trying to nail it down one way or the other, and the Greeks aren't even worried about it. That's just the way they talk. Okay, so keep that in mind. We'll get into locative and instrumental tomorrow. Those are perhaps the most controversial ones of all.